Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining in this latest episode of Chaser Takeaway, in-depth interviews with a leading expert on a question of importance for British Army and Defence. And obviously, these are views that are shared between two experts, academics and researchers. They do not reflect the views of Minister of Defence of the British Army. And today we're discussing ISIS. Now, you might be forgiven not to have paid attention to what's happening with ISIS in Iraq and Syria or the fight against ISIS, because 2020 has been quite a busy year in terms of news agendas and the challenges that we face. But things are not going all right. The caliph is dead. The caliphate has disappeared. We have thousands of people still militants and their families and their social networks in detention. But since January, pretty much, we have seen a surge in their activities and attacks, both in Iraq and in Syria, in some mix almost 2-3 attacks in a wide geography, and developing new tactics, developing their resilience and adaptability, and ISIS is back as a question. It has never really went away. So today we want to explore where things are with ISIS and fight against ISIS in a overall context in Syria, and what this means for the coalition and for the UK. And we're thrilled to have Hassan Hassan, who's a leading expert of ISIS and Syria, and a good friend of our Chaser, and has contributed to our work before. Hassan, thank you so much for joining this discussion. I'll just ask the first question and right away give you a chance to explain on that. Your center, based in Washington, D.C., has produced some really good studies lately on the current activities of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. What are some of the key findings that you guys found in regards to what kind of actions it takes, its operations, its regrouping, its financing, and its current reach in both of these theaters?
Well, thank you. Always great to speak with Chaser. Last time I visited there was great. So recently, we've seen obviously a spike of attacks over the past, especially since April, maybe March. There were signs that ISIS is back. Some people tracked activities of ISIS, especially since January, like I said, the beginning of the year. And the interesting thing is how to basically understand what's going on. Is it really a comeback of ISIS? Is it a resurgence? How is this different from last year? For example, I think it's very interesting kind of to follow the patterns of what happened over the past year. Because last year, in March last year, we saw the collapse of the caliphate, the territorial, the last area, Baghouz in eastern Syria. This is an area where I come from, actually. This is the basically the last area that ISIS controlled and lost. And then we had a kind of a period of weakness, maybe attempts by ISIS to come back to stay relevant. It did, you know, conduct some attacks. But generally speaking, over the past year in Syria, we observed that ISIS actually was weak and was under sustained pressure for almost all last year, with some exceptions, obviously. And things start to change this year. In Iraq, I think probably a year or two of kind of sustained pressure. We saw ISIS trying to attack here and there, but we saw the Iraqis and the Americans and the US-led coalition, obviously with Britain and other countries, conducting these clearing operations that followed the capture of Mosul and Raqqa later on, to kind of weaken ISIS presence in villages and rural areas in parts of Iraq and Syria, especially in eastern Iraq and eastern Syria and northern Iraq and northern Syria and western Iraq as well. Then something happened in October last year, or actually a series of things happened. First, we saw the Donald Trump announcing abruptly the withdrawal from Syria. And that was followed by kind of some chaos where Turkey went in and kind of used that and intervened in northern Syria, tried to seize the Kurdish areas in the north. That was followed by panic on the part of the Kurdish-dominated Syrian democratic forces in eastern Syria that helped liberate much of eastern Syria. And then people started to see maybe this is really an opportunity for ISIS to, you know, to take advantage because of the chaos. The Kurds went to the Assad regime and Russia and tried to basically prevent, with their help, Turkey from further and, you know, basically incursion in northern Syria. So there were fears. There were real fears that ISIS would come back. Now, the interesting thing that ISIS actually didn't take advantage of these attacks. And in my my theory is that ISIS couldn't because it was under serious, sustained pressure because of the immense, campaign that ISIS, that basically the Americans in Iraq and the Iraqis and as well as the Syrians had, launched against ISIS. But then there were started to, and that's the interesting thing. After October, you started to see openings for ISIS. Again, we had the chaos that followed the Donald Trump said, withdrawal from Syria. Then the tension between the Iranian proxies in both Iraq and Syria and the Americans, and that kind of made it harder for the Americans to cooperate with the Iraqis. We saw the Iranian proxies controlling much of the borders between Syria and Iraq. So there was a lot of security gaps. And slowly, gradually, it took ISIS some time, but ISIS started to recover in January. And it seized on these multiple events that that happened, despite the sustained pressure against it before that. So people started to kind of really work on anything except ISIS. And then we saw in January the height of that, or the peak of the tension between the United States and the Iranian proxies with the killing of General Qasem Soleimani. So things started to look really well for ISIS. There are favorable conditions that would, that ISIS would seize. But it took us some time. And I think that's a very important observation because it indicated that ISIS needed that time because it was under so much pressure. It was weak internally. But at the same time, it was internal, like internal structures of ISIS were still intact in much of the way, which is, sounds like a contradiction, but it's not, in the sense that ISIS under pressure, but internally as an organization, it was able to seize an opportunity, but it took it some time to seize that opportunity. So some of the observations that we saw from scholars and observers who studied the ISIS on the ground in Syria and Iraq is that ISIS started to recover early January, and then now in April started to conduct these large-scale coordinated impressive attacks in fact in some parts of Iraq and Syria. And we tried to dig deeper than just follow this spike of attacks, like just more attacks happening. So we tracked how ISIS started to become more visible and more confident in some villages and towns in parts of Iraq. And from Iraq, we had Dr. Hisham Hashimi, for example, was one of the best, if not the best, observer of ISIS in Iraq, tracking how ISIS a year or two years ago, it was mostly operating in open areas in mountains like Hamrin Mountain, mountains and areas in the kind of no man zones almost between, Kirkuk, Salah ad-Din, Diyala, in northern eastern Iraq. And now they moved from those areas to actual, like the suburbs of Iraq, to cities of Iraq and start to attack, and that kind of, that visibility is very, very important. And that's a really dangerous warning sign that ISIS is indeed not just an indicator, is not just a spike of attacks, but ISIS increased visibility and mobility in both countries, in Iraq and Syria. And Syria is still in places like Deir ez-Zor and the Syrian desert. So from Homs to the Syrian-Iraqi borders, rather than to, for example, Hasakah and Raqqa, we still haven't seen much activities there, but it's still becoming, ISIS is becoming more confident, essentially.
It's fascinating, Hassan. Obviously, as you already hinted, this organization from day one faced tremendous external pressure, right? There was maybe initially a chance for them to expand and take control and win quick battles with, for various reasons. But since the coalition with SDF, with Iraq, with all the regional actors in Syria, Assad regime in Russia and Iran, etc., and how much pressure it survived, and it's regrouping and it's adapting, right? Some of its tactical operations, some of its operations in Iraq and Syria, small groups of men targeting the way that they undertook those operations, as well as the question of funding, right? They lost a lot of funding for the last 2 years. They're still able to operate, even though a lot of people are in prison, some senior ones have been killed. What is the formula, if you like, behind their resilience, right? I mean, are we going to, theologically or ideologically, they haven't been as robust as some other groups, and clearly still they have an appeal among people who supported them. It might not be visible. Clearly they have sleeper cells or people counting on days. Is it about militants who have nothing to do except to fight because they gave up on everything? Is it about the grievances that are still there? Is it about maybe a constituency they have that we're not paying close attention to, grievances or other factors that is enabling their resilience?
This is really interesting, because if you want to if you haven't really been observing ISIS, suddenly you start looking, for example, you can easily understand what's happening by looking over the past 1 year. It's a timeline. ISIS collapsed, its caliphate collapsed, and how it sought, return, and how that was happening despite people not liking them, local people not liking them, despite the immense pressure against them. Remember, the US-led coalition is a massive cup, launched this, probably one of the most impressive campaigns, military campaigns in modern history, against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, especially around Mosul. So, the key thing here is really experience. ISIS had experience, had done this before, has seen this movie before, and others, even though they also understand ISIS and they think they've seen this movie before and they think they're more prepared, they're not as much committed to this consistent long war that ISIS speaks about, it's ISIS simply replicating what it did before. We spoke a lot about this before, or speaking like we write, a lot of observers on ISIS write about this, but ISIS in 2008, when it was defeated in Iraq, it tried to learn the lessons, and one of the conversations that they had was basically, how do we survive this deeply hostile environment that we had in Iraq back in 2008? And 2008 was basically arguably much worse than the situation for ISIS today. Because at the time, it was limited, confined in Iraq, and confined to parts of Iraq, and the Sunni forces were around it, turned against it, even though, and those forces knew it very well because they operated alongside them for a long time. And you had the Americans, and you had the Iraqi government, and you had all of them basically turning against them. So they didn't have numbers, they didn't have the same numbers that we have today. The UN estimates that ISIS today has somewhere between 18,000 to 20,000 fighters. Could be exaggeration, but our experts on the ground and observers and people we speak to think that makes sense if you consider all the infrastructure that ISIS, manpower and so on and so forth, that ISIS uses on the ground. It could be that number, and probably that's very realistic. So what I mean by that is not people who just fight and carry arms and move in this 10 to 11 mobile cells to fight here and there in some open areas, but the sleeper cells and the part-timers, some people who just do something for them every now and then, things like that, or the network that they use. So definitely ISIS has more favorable conditions today than it had in Iraq, and it learned from the same playbook, is that you just sustain a campaign against anyone you see as a potential threat for you in the future. So in Iraq, they started with the Sunnis, and they started picking specific targets related to the Iraqi government, people who work in the intelligence, people who work in security, people who work in government, so on and so forth, police, as well as people like Mukhtars, the elder, like the town elders, or someone who work, people who work with the government. So they targeted any pillars, any resources, any people who would create an alternative for ISIS, a kind of a firm alternative on the ground, to keep these areas brittle, weak, and ISIS able to maneuver and swim in that ocean of problems in Iraq. And now we have, instead of one ocean, which is Iraq, we have two, you know, Iraq and Syria and beyond. So ISIS is certainly bigger, but you have to also recognize the weaknesses that ISIS, when it was collapsed back, you know, in Iraq and Syria, early last year, it was really weak. And that was an opportunity for the US-led coalition to sustain the pressure. The thing is, they did sustain the pressure for a year, probably even less than a year. And then as ISIS started to show more and more weaknesses, we started to see that pressure being lifted from ISIS. And actually, I have a theory that the killing of Abu Bakr Baghdadi in October last year was actually a byproduct of that sustained pressure, because there was a campaign going on in Iraq and Syria. If you go back to the days before he was supposedly relocated from Iraq into northern Syria, there was a sustained campaign, relentless campaign conducted by both the Iraq and the US-led coalitions. A coalition in different parts of Iraq called the Will of Victory. Mm-hmm. And you don't have that, you hear a lot about the campaign, but it's actually very interesting, because this enabled the Iraqis to slowly go after ISIS in remote areas and conduct that relentless campaign against ISIS that forced Baghdadi to feel, oh, they're getting very close to us, to their hideouts and so on and so forth. And so at some point he felt that his, the kind of the campaign and the bombing and the operations started to get very closer to him. So he had to think of an alternative, maybe not an ideal alternative, but it had to be a temporary hideout until things go back to normal in Iraq, and for the organization. So all these indicate two things. One is that ISIS knows how to come back. It has the commitment to come back. Its enemies can defeat ISIS, but they don't have the patience to continue that process, which takes some time for ISIS to crumble from within. It doesn't happen in 1 year. It takes more.
Hassan, I think you already kind of hinted at the complex foreign policies the US has, the US partners, allies in Europe have towards the field, like towards the fight itself. You already hinted at Trump's decision to pull US troops out in that messy year, a few months, about are they staying, are they going, if they're staying, what are they doing, created an opportunity for ISIS to seize the moment. You also hinted regional actors as well too, but what does the current kind of comeback or adaptation or reincarnation of ISIS mean for the coalition from now on? I mean, you hinted already the fact that when the coalition pulled its foot from the acceleration, if you like, from the pedal, ISIS again reemerged. Is what the solution is, therefore, is it further focused on the field, given the pandemic that is unfolding, given all sorts of complexities that is unfolding in both in Europe and in North America? How likely is this? And what are key areas or key deliverables that can be achieved? I mean, key focuses that actually the coalition should maintain, or key stakeholders maybe that we should be working with?
Yeah, so it's the solution is easy and difficult at the same time. By that, I mean, there is a dilemma in Iraq today, which is that in order to defeat ISIS and kind of put, reverse its resurgence, its current resurgence, which is actually very short-lived. It's only started in April, like the real one. There's some signs of recovery in January, but in April, when it started to conduct these large-scale coordinated attacks. So in order to reverse this phase of essentially resurgence by ISIS, you need deeper engagement by the US-led coalition. You know, we have to be honest about it. Iraqis cannot do it on their own. They can talk about how, all these kind of things, but they do need the air support by the Americans. This is really what made the biggest difference, the US-led coalition. Air support. This is what made it all the difference in the campaign against ISIS, the five-year campaign against ISIS. Now, the dilemma is that ISIS is recovering. That deeper engagement is not going to be possible because of the tension between the US and the Iraqis. that you know, Iraqis are calling for the Americans to leave, you know, the US-led coalition and Americans to leave Iraq. So how do you solve this? Because the irony is that the reasons that enabled ISIS resurgence, current resurgence, are these tensions between the US and the Iraqis. But the solution to basically curb this resurgence by ISIS is to somehow magically solve the problems between the Iranian proxies and the US in Iraq. So it's becoming harder, and that's why the solution is easy in the sense that you go back to that engagement that we saw last year and really conduct these clearing operations against ISIS. ISIS is becoming richer by the day, because they have more mobility and they can extort and they can go back to their ways of making money,
or they smashes the money they saved somewhere. Yeah,
exactly. And they saved a lot of money as well over the years. So but at the same time, difficult because the political reality, we know that nobody is interested in re-engaging in Iraq and Syria. And the reason why is that it's easy to mobilize against an organization that has taken over Syria and Iraq, or parts of Iraq and Syria. But it's harder to get people to go and say, oh, there's some operations in Anbar, in the Syrian Badia, in Deir ez-Zor, in Kirkuk, and so on and so forth. Nobody really can mobilize or rally people for such a thing. And that gives ISIS some time. And my estimation is that if the current trends continue for the rest of this year, and by these trends, I mean ISIS recovering slowly and gradually, steadily, but at the same time, the Iraqis are busy with their own problems. In addition to the US, the developments I mentioned earlier, like the Donald Trump withdrawal from Syria, the Turkish invasion of part of Syria, and the killing of Qasem Soleimani, we also had a protest in Iraq, the unprecedented popular protests in Iraq that rocked Baghdad for several months, and that forced the Iraqi government to resign. And then since the resignation of the Iraqi government, they couldn't agree to a new prime minister until yesterday.
Yeah.
And hopefully the new, Mustafa Kadhimi would be able to kind of get people, he has big tasks ahead of him. He has to deal with the coronavirus. He has to deal with the political stagnation, the economic stagnation.
The oil prices.
And the oil prices, exactly. And all these tensions in Iraq and between the Iraq and the US and so on and so forth. So it's not easy.
Yes.
But
yeah.
In theory, it is easy.
Yeah, in theory, it is easier than done. But Hassan, obviously, ISIS doesn't operate in a vacuum, as you already pointed out rightfully. The conditions in Iraq, the conditions in Syria, what external actors do matter and creates the space for it. But often there's a tendency or a weakness in DC, in London, in Brussels, in Paris, to look at this only as ISIS. But there's a larger Syria question, right, that we cannot really ignore, because it's clearly entangled, even though our main security concern might very well be ISIS. There's a larger question about where things are in Syria. What's happening in northwest Syria with Idlib, for example? We've seen the tensions with Turkey and Turkish operations with drones and taking down Syrian Assad regime forces and tanks and armored vehicles, even risking taking down some Russian mercenaries. You have the northeast Syria question with the question around YPG, PKK in Turkey, ageless kind of question that is yet to be resolved. And then lately, you have seen the video leaks, well, recordings by a Syrian businessman that is a cousin of Assad, who benefited and sponsored this regime, broadcasted by Russia Today. Clearly, things are not really okay within the Assad clique, as well as relations with Russia. And then you've seen the reports by the Israeli defense minister commenting on how, for the first time, they're observing Iranian pullout from some of the bases and facilities shrinking down. Obviously, that's related to the pandemic, but also Iran's own economic conditions and as well as geopolitical calculations. But there is an overall context of Syria after all these years. It is obviously, in some sense, impossible to forecast where things are heading. But you look at this picture of very stretched, prolonged civil war with these many local actors and regional actors and international actors. What are your main points or observation over the direction of the civil war in Syria? What it might mean in the immediate term or long term? Or are we settled in for the next 10, 20, 30 decades to see this brokenness and millions of refugees with now the pandemic concerns, you know, whether or not coronavirus is spreading among refugees, which is something I think is not talked enough, the human cost and the vulnerabilities these people have. What do you see where the overall picture in Syria heading?
That's good. I mean, so there's so much, obviously, to talk about in Syria. It kind of requires a time of its own. But basically, first of all, we'll start with, I mean, there are three things to say. First is that Iraq and Syria both have so much potential for these organizations to survive. You know, we usually talk about the popular support for these organizations, but it's not really the popular support. The popular support is a factor that comes later. First, it starts with a security vacuum that enables these organizations to create an infrastructure for themselves. And after they create the infrastructure for themselves, it becomes easy to rally certain segments of that society for them, either bribe them or intimidate them. And that creates these gaps and fields of operation for these organizations. So Iraq and Syria, that's the first one, will always be a problem when it comes to these organizations, because nobody is willing to kind of sustain that long-term pressure. Mm. And resolve the problems. You know, it's not always about grievances, but grievances are important, key, in fact. I think there, this security vacuum would not have been created without these problems that exist in both countries. In Syria, also another thing is that really everything depends on what happens in Idlib, in the northwestern Syria, because once things unravel there. There's some sort of quiet these days. Every now and then, the Assad regime threatens to take over Idlib, but we have the most seasoned fighters and most committed people against the Assad regime. Once that area is taken, then we'll start to see another phase of the Syrian conflict that, in my opinion, has been deferred by this control of area in the northwest. Having that area of control means that some of these potential scenarios are delayed. They're not yet there yet, but there are serious scenarios that we have to consider. And one is this: once you have unraveling of the Syrian conflict, we see insurgency going back not just in that area, but throughout Syria, in the south, in the center, and so on and so forth. For now, only ISIS almost is active in eastern Syria. There's some activities in the northwest, but the one that really conducts these attacks is ISIS, and ISIS trying to establish itself. Once Idlib is retaken, recaptured by the Assad regime, I think there will be scenarios where the whole of Syria will be more like Iraq in 2013 and just before 14. So these are things that you have to consider, because we still have problems, political problems unresolved, and Assad regime, every time we feel that Assad regime is ready to take that last part of Syria, announce victory and so on and so forth, a new problem comes up. Last year, we saw the almost collapse of the Syrian currency. And now we saw these tensions within the House of Assad, essentially, the regime, the top echelon of the Assad regime. And these are serious. We actually don't know. Nobody knows. Everyone is speculating about what is behind these videos by Rami Makhlouf, Assad's cousin. But we know, what we know is that there is tension, obviously, between Assad and his wife on one hand and the Makhlouf on the other, when it comes to, financial, disagreements on financial stuff. And then you have the tension between Russia and Makhlouf, and then you have Iran also going after Makhlouf. And then Maher al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad, usually who has a kind of a more aggressive person, is also against Makhlouf. And they have basically multiple tension points there. And this, before we saw these videos, there were signs that these are their disagreements. One is, for example, this tug of war, a media war between the Assads and the Makhlous, when there's a massive drug smuggling operation was busted by the Egyptians, and that many people know, many people suspect, I think rightly, that that the Assads somehow gave a tip to the Egyptians to capture it, and Rami Makhlouf denied that it belonged to him, and then there was a leak about Asma al-Assad, Bashar Assad's wife, buying this very expensive painting, for example. So there's that kind of petty, but also serious tension between this thing. Now, what to make of this? I think on one hand, obviously, this is a result of the war and what happened. And these are gonna, the people who conducted the campaign are gonna devour each other in a sense. But also, you could also see it from a different perspective, which is that this is symptomatic that they feel more comfortable to start these petty disagreements, feeling that they are more at ease because the war is no longer as intense as it used to be. So they now went or climbed down the hill to collect the war spoils, essentially, in Syria. And Russia says, this is the time for reckoning and so on and so forth. We have to put our house in order. So some parts of the Assad regime propaganda is that, part of it, is that this is Assad going after getting rid of the external enemy, now going after the internal enemy of corruption and so on and so forth. Obviously, that's not true, but it's really complex. You can't just there's so much speculation about it. But what we know is that there is a real problem happening there in Damascus.
Yeah, Hassan, thank you so much. Obviously, these are very big topics, and we could extend this conversation for quite some time. But few key takeaway points from this conversation for me has been that this is not really the first time ISIS has relaunched itself or its activities. It learns its lessons, it adapts. It still is able to garner some funds and support and recruit. It still has battle-hardened militants that are willing to take these operations. And even though it lost this caliph, and it still has some sort of structure to be able to pull it all together. And unless we have a policy of paying attention and once again focusing on this, even though it disappeared from our national agendas in the UK, in the US, and in Europe because of our own domestic challenges, as well as lack of interest in Iraq and Syria, especially for the public discussions, there is actually a risk that we're creating the same breeding ground for these groups to emerge again and basically assume control of territory. Hassan, thank you so much for joining, and thank you to all of you who watched this, and thanks again. See you soon.